mitzvah shin nun vav 356. Shelo lishanos hakodshim mikorban lakorban. Not to change the sanctified status of any sanctified animal. Meaning, as opposed to what we were talking about before, which is the prohibition of tamura, which is saying, well, I'm replacing this sacrificial animal with that sacrificial animal. This is not that. This is saying about this one animal that I consecrated it as a shlumim, and I want to change it into an ola, whatever. Whatever different types of animal, different types of sacrifices there could be. So to change the animal. Shelo l'shanos hakodshim mikorban l'korban. Goin shenachzer ha-shlumim osham. To change the shlumim into a guilt offering. A shlamim is one of the least sanctified types of korbanos because the shlamim is eaten by the owners, whereas other korbanos are eaten only by the kohanim or not eaten at all. Or a guilt offering, change it into a sin offering. A sin offering is generally more stringent than an asham. Bezev hadome lo yesh bo lav. All these things are subject to a negative commandment. Valdover ze nemar bechan bevchor. The pasuk doesn't say it regarding all the korbanos individually, but rather gives just the example of a bechor, which is a firstborn animal, which is we'll discuss in four mitzvos from now. We'll go on a length about the laws of a bechor. So it just gives the bechor as an example by saying lo yakdish ish oso kilomer shleyase bechor lo ola velo shlam velo korban achar. So you shall not sanctify a bechor. So a bechor already is sanctified. So what do you mean? What do you mean you shouldn't sanctify a bechor? What it means is you shouldn't change the bechor, the firstborn animal, to a different type of korban. We know that a bechor is brought to Yerushalayim and it is offered up and eaten there. Uva ha-kabbalah de lavdavka bevechor hikbidako. So meaning that's just giving an example. It's not saying that you just shouldn't change the firstborn animal, but rather any type of animal, you should not change its sacrificial status. This is talking about, so the Sifri says, from the simple reading of the pasuk, maybe I would think it's only referring to a bechor. So what about all the other sacrificial animals? You shouldn't change the type of sacrifice that's going to be. Tamalomar babehima lo yakdishi shoso. So if you take the last pasuk ends with the word babehima, in any animal, regarding any animal, you shouldn't sanctify it. So it means that it's and then it says, it goes on talking about the bechor. So by combining those two psukim, so it's an allusion to the fact, yirmos bechol behema kedusha, kedusha ben kedusha lekodshim yizbeach, alfilo bedei kabai, shein meshan osa migdushasa. So that you shouldn't change a sanctified animal to another type of holiness. I'm sorry, when you talk about Bedek Abayis, you can redeem it, but you shouldn't change it. I misspoke before. You shouldn't change it to a different type of Bedek Abayis, of donation to the temple treasury. You shouldn't change it, but rather it should remain as is. Mishor Shea Mitzvah, Mashikosad Mitzvah, Say Beis, Betmura Kozele Moraz HaKodesh. Meaning that we should be nervous about dealing with sacrificial animals. You shouldn't just say, oh, I don't feel like giving it as this type of korban, so I'm going to switch it. No, once you sanctify it, you should be like, you know, I'm not going to touch it. It has to be the way it is. Midini ha-mitzvah, ma-sha-amru zichron le-vracha, shim hikdish le-bedek ha-hecha, lo yishan le-bedek ha-mizbech. So if you sanctified an animal to be sold and the money used to repair the actual building of the Beis HaMikdash, the sanctuary, so you shouldn't change it to repair the altar. V'chein kol keyotze b'zeh. V'od amru, gam kein shein ma'rimin al beimas ha-hekdesh la-hekdesh ubara kedusha acheres. So you shouldn't say that when you have a pregnant sanctified animal, so you shouldn't say that the fetus, when it's born, is going to be a different type of korban. But rather, it's supposed to be the same korban, el-arei b'kedushas imo. That the holiness of the mother is transferred to the child. Shivlados hakodshim yimei iman hein kedoshim. That already, if a sacrificial animal is pregnant or gets pregnant, so then the holiness is transferred to the offspring. So this idea goes by the mother. I mean, the father, we know that by animals, you know, really, in most cases, you don't go by the father at all. There's a shayla exactly in which cases, choshishin lezerahav, but it's like when it grows in the holy environment, that confers kedusha on the fetus, just like by humans. So, you know, that what it goes by the mother, that when the mother is Jewish, so the child is Jewish, and the mother is goyish, so the child is not Jewish. So it has to do with the environment and the way that the child grows in a holy environment. Now, obviously, you can't use this so much as a halachic proof text for the issue I'm about to bring up, but it's maybe a smidgen of a suggestion that there's this whole there's a whole shaila about what happens when a when nowadays we have reproductive technologies. That the ovum, the egg, and the womb belong to different women. Mm-hmm. There's a donor egg, and maybe maybe there's a Jewish woman who is totally capable of carrying a child to term, but she doesn't ovulate well for some reason, and so she wants to have a donor egg from a non-Jewish woman. And so the question is the child Jewish or not? Does it go by the does it go by the egg, the genetic mother, or does it go by the gestational mother? So this is it, yeah.
No, wait. You wouldn't want to have a Jewish woman because of
yichus issues, okay, right? Right. Okay. You would bedafka want to have a non-Jewish donor.
Why?
Because yes. Now, if it's a Jewish woman, so let's say a Jewish woman donates an egg to another Jewish woman.
Yeah.
So then maybe down the she doesn't know to whom she donated, so maybe down the line their children will become engaged and they'll want to get married and they won't know that they're actually, you know, might be halachically brother and sister. But if it's a non-Jewish woman, it's not a problem.
But if you're going to say that they're brother and sister halachically,
then
you're
saying brother and sister.
Well, whatever. You're okay. But you're lying on possibility. Then you're kind of waiting it that the genetic mother is the mother.
Right. No, no. Well, hold on, hold on, yeah, hold on. Okay. I'm getting there. So okay. the same thing would occur in the opposite case, of course, where a woman produces fine eggs, but she cannot carry a child to term, so she uses a surrogate mother who's not Jewish. So with that, it's her genetic offspring, but it's not her womb. So what is the status of the child? So this Shaila has not been completely clarified. I mean, there's so many, it's hard to bring a strong, absolute proof for either opinion. But I just wanted to say that this this idea is maybe a tiny suggestion that it goes by the environment that the child was nurtured in. But lemaisa, in terms of the practical halakha conclusion, the practice nowadays in, I don't want to say all, but in serious Orthodox communities, that if either the genetic or the gestational mother is not Jewish, so the child undergoes a conversion at birth just to cover all bases to make sure that they're...
That's repeated later.
That's repeated at bus or bar mitzvah, right? You can't convert a kid at birth, can you?
You can.
But it's conditional on him accepting it.
Well, but this person is only a Suffolk convert.
Oh, so
maybe the child really was born Jewish, and maybe the child is a convert. Oh. So there's no backing out of that type of conversion. So the truth is, I don't know if you really need to tell him or her.
This is a real case.
But probably it's wise in general. I mean, the truth is, in terms of a person's self-perception, so it's probably more severe to learn that the woman that you thought all your life was your mother. Was not actually your gestational mother, but was actually... I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's harder to learn that your person you think is your mother is not your genetic mother than it is to learn that your person you thought was your mother was is not really your gestational mother. Because
we take for granted that, you know, genetics is more important than
right.
You know,
who is
9
the,
months in the womb. Yeah, right.
Who
right.
is the grandparents?
What do you mean?
I mean, who do you consider the grandparents? The genetic ones or the gestational ones? The parents.
I mean, but practically, it's going to be the grandparents. It's going to be whoever
the Jewish ones,
right?
Yeah,
the one because they're the ones who are raising the child.
Well, this is a real Heather has two mommies.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
they're
yeah,
two, they're both mommies.
I mean, obviously, you're right. Obviously, a Jewish woman should not donate an egg to a non-Jewish woman. Then you get really serious problems. Mm-hmm. Certainly not.
Seal the records.
Yeah. Okay. So. Fine. Masha'en ken bebechor, shabechor betziyaso min hu miskadesh. Epet arechem tala kosov. So this is not the case by a bechor. So if a chatas gets pregnant, then the offspring will have the holiness of a chatas. But this doesn't apply to a bechor, the firstborn, because that doesn't apply. That's not intrinsic holiness. That applies only to the firstborn animal once it exits the womb.
So in other words, you designate a pregnant animal as a chatas, and then it turns out that
it's going to be a bechor. Right. Okay, so if it's okay. So even in a regular animal, so say a regular animal, you know that a regular animal, regular chulin, not holy animal and all, is pregnant for the first time, then you're allowed to say the fetus that my cow is carrying should be ola, okay? Should be an ola, because the animal is not yet imbued with the holiness of a bechor. The holiness of the bechor only occurs when the animal exits the birth canal, or enters, whatever, goes through the birth canal. It's those muscles squeezing it out that endow it with holiness. So the fact that you changed it in utero, it doesn't undo its holiness. Mm-hmm. So that you're allowed to do, and you don't know for sure. What if it's maybe it's going to be a female, and then it won't be a bechor, and maybe it's going to be maybe a C-section. Yeah,
we're going actually, couple of, we can happen. Yeah. Right.
So we were discussing a couple of weeks ago animal C-section. So if the animal has a C-section, if the baby animal is born by C-section, not only is it not a bechor, but it cannot be offered as a korban at all.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's one of the differences between people and the animals. That in a person who is born by C-section has no restrictions whatsoever. Even if that person is a Kohen, he's allowed to worship in the Beis HaMikdash. The only it's not a restriction, but we'll just be exempt from a pidyon event. Fine, but there's no restrictions vis-a-vis that person's halachic acceptability for anything. Whereas by an animal, if an animal is born by C-section, is not allowed to be used as a korban. Valzen emar asher yivukar lashem lo yakdishisho. So mishi yivukar iyata makdisho. You're only allowed to switch the kedusha once it attains the whole full status of a bechor, which is at birth. Aval ata makdisho babetan. You could change the status. You could sanctify it in utero so that it won't be a bechor when it comes out. Well, figach mishomrim teilat zochar hamavakeres. Harehu ola yakrbo sol ola. So if you change this firstborn fetus, pregnancy fetus to an ola, so it becomes an ola. Aval eino yochol asoso zivche shlamim. Levish eino yochol afgiel migdushaso. So if you have a first pregnancy animal and you say, I want it to be a shlamim, you might think, okay, no problem, it's still in utero, so I'm allowed to change it to whatever I want. No. Because a shlamim lemata himina bechor. A shlamim is less holy than a bechor. So in essence, you're saying you're undoing its inevitable kedusha. You're not adding on to the status, but you're detracting from it. So you're not allowed to detract. You're allowed to add. Shabechor nechal lekohanim levad v'shlamim lechol adam. So bechor, the firstborn animal, is eaten only to kohanim. And the shlamim may be eaten by anyone. The aser prateh b'perek chamishim itmura, the fifth perek of tmura. But noeg yisuzeb b'chol makom b'chol zman, all places and all times. B'zachar munikevu shafilu b'zman hazeh she'ein makdishin mishalvar vikdish behema lehekdash echad eino yachol l'shanosa lehekdash acher. So even nowadays, you're not really supposed to sanctify animals, but if you do, you're not allowed to change your status. B'over hazeh v'shina osa mikdusha l'kdusha kigon shekdisha l'shlamim v'amar achakach shekdusha olo l'korban acher. You change the status. Over alav zeh you violate his negative commandment. Ain lokin alav l'visha ain b'maisa. So this does not receive the penalty of Malkus, unlike Tabura, which is considered to be especially severe. This is has no action associated, so therefore
the action takes place when the actual korban is offered, though, right? You haven't, by going ahead and making the declaration, you haven't done anything, but it's going to result in a different action than would have happened otherwise, right?
Okay, but the actual, at the point that you violated the prohibition, there was no action taking place. But that's a good point, yeah. Mitzvah Shin Nun Zayin, 357. Mitzvah's Din Macharim Min Achosev Shul HaKohanim. If you, how do you say Macharim in English? What's the art scroll say? You cheremize. Okay, that's an excellent, excellent English word. Excommunication is not the cherem we're talking about over here. So cherem really means, cherem means to set aside, but it's like, it's a unique Hebrew word that's like setting aside in a cursed manner.
Okay.
It's not just like, cursed, you know, I'm setting cursed or worthlessness, okay? So it's not like I'm setting aside my phone, I'm putting it over here. But it means that it's like, in essence, a curse.
Casting it out.
And it's like, this is not what we're talking about over here, but you're right. There is this idea of putting someone in cherem. There's nothing to do with what we say over here. But that cherem is the second level of excommunication. There's the milder excommunication, which is called nidui, where, you know, you're not allowed to wear shoes and people aren't generally supposed to talk to you. But I think if you have, they're allowed to do.
Wait, you're not allowed to wear shoes?
Yeah, people who are in Nidui are not allowed to wear shoes, yeah.
What are they
it's like,
to
yeah, yeah, it's like Tisha B'Av. Like, they're supposed to be, feel rejected and, you know, unsettled.
Is it part of their
Kapara, yeah, it's part of, yeah, it's part of their atonement, yeah.
Can they wear burlap bags on their feet?
Yeah, yeah, it would apply, like, on Tisha B'Av, yeah. Same, same idea.
You wouldn't notice these days.
Flip-flop.
The, right, so that, so you still have to do a little business, but someone who's completely, you're not supposed to have anything to do with at all is called being in cherem, but generally you put someone in nidui first, and then if they fail to rectify themselves, then you switch to the second level of cherem. But nowadays we don't usually use the word nidui colloquially when we talk about putting someone in excommunication. We just say, oh, you have to put them in cherem. But actually, the second level of excommunication would generally only be used, not always, and there might be severe cases where you go straight to cherem. But generally, you do nidui first. So this is pretty rare nowadays because the Jewish community doesn't have the power that it used to. In the olden days, you know, you say, okay, you're a nidui. The you know, someone major in the community puts you a nidui, or the bezdin puts you a nidui, and you'd be like, oh no, no one's going to do business with me. Okay, I have to take off my shoes now. I have to start, you know, repenting, and maybe they'll lift my nidui. You put someone in nidui nowadays, they'll be like, okay, like, I'm moving to Chicago, you know, like, no one's gonna know. Okay, you might post on Facebook that this person is in Nidui, but it doesn't really have the same effect unless you have a very tight-knit Jewish community.
Which wouldn't post on Facebook.
Which wouldn't post on Facebook.
Yeah, so that's the cherem that we colloquially refer to, but this cherem is related in the terms of the etymology. I mean, it's the same word. But it's not talking about excommunicating a person. It's talking about ladun bedinei charamim kolomar shekol mi shehecherim davar min achasav stam yon shamar davar ploni mimashi yeshli hecherim. You designate it regarding an object that you own. So if you want to say, you know, my grand piano is now cherim, I now curse it. Not interested. You had a really bad recital. And you're not interested in it anymore, so cherem, get rid of the piano. She knows it owes a dover la kohen. So what happens? Even though, so your intention, as the Sefer Chinuch is going to explain, is to get rid of it and curse it and totally disassociate yourself from it. But the Torah says that no, that doesn't work. We don't gratuitously get rid of property, but rather if you do such a thing, so this thing, its object should be given to a kohen. Shemar ach kol cherem asher yacharim ish, ela imkein amar beferosh acher mi el Hashem olavedek habayis. But that's the assumption, this is a machlokes tanoim in Erchin, that what it means when you just say such and such an object should be in cherem. Does it mean that is the object supposed to go into the possession of the Kohanim, or is it supposed to go into the possession of the Beis HaMikdash? So that's the machlokas over there. With, if you don't specify, so we paskin based on the Rambam, we paskin according to the majority opinion in the Mishnah over there that it belongs to the Kohanim unless you specify. Again, both opinions agree that if you specify to the other one, that it works. The question is what type of cherem is it when you don't specify?
Now, what sort of property is generally kept, you know, not a grand piano or something like that? I mean, it's not like, for example, we could say, okay, we have all this stuff in storage, and we don't want to pay somebody to get rid of it, so we could say, oh, we put a harem on it, and all of a sudden now the cops come in and take it away. I mean,
they don't have to.
Okay. But so, in other words, usually this would be, what, like, say, a piece of real property?
Real property is a different story. Okay. Let's talk about first movable property. All right. But it could be anything. Really, it could be anything. Whether they want to take it or not, again, it's a totally different story. They can give it back to you if they want. They say, I'm not interested.
But what can you do with something which you put a harem on?
Yeah, good question. Excellent question. Shekach Omru Zichron al-Vracha Stam Charamim la-Kohanim. He's quoting the opinion of the Mishnah that says, if you don't specify the beneficiary of your harem, then it goes to the Kohanim. That's the implication of that pasuk, which is why that opinion in the Mishnah says that it's that's the stam understanding of a cherem. Yishorshia mitzvah levishi Yisrael hu ha'am asher bochar akel mikol shar ha'umos ha'amim la'avodasu la'hakir shmo. So the Jewish people is the one that God chose to know Him, know His name. They don't go a mazel Yisrael, is the famous statement that we're not under the control of the constellations. So why do we say mazel tov? Okay, no. This is a shaila exactly how much to apply that. Fine. So the other nations don't have as close access to God. And God appoints, you know, messengers to deal with the fate of the other nations, but God has seized our fate by Himself. God, we are the property of God. That when God redeemed us from Egypt, it was a miracle that affected everyone. So God Himself took us out of Egypt. As we know, Kemoshe Darshu Zichron Bracha. Yeah? Come on. Aninanana. Vavarti Verbizraim. Anivelo Malach. Vizigevichor. Anivelo Sarav. Anivelo Ashaliach. Ani Hashem. Anivelo Acher. Right? We know from the Haggadah that we can all recite by heart that it was God personally. So it says in the Passover Haggadah. I bet you didn't expect to be thinking about Pesach at this time of year, but okay, the Sefer Chinuch is quoting the Haggadah to make a hashkafic point. So when the Jewish people are careful about the observance of the Torah and crown themselves with the worship of God, you know, they're proud of it. So only good and abundance of blessing and holiness, etc., is going to support them. The opposite of this abundance and blessing is curse and cherem, setting aside, you know, disengaging. Aloi vehem v'sonehem. Is going to be. I'm sorry. So if the Jewish people are good, so the rest of the nations will be set aside. Basically, we're analyzing your intention. That if you say, I'm putting some of my property in a cherem, I'm setting it aside. I want to curse it. I want its destruction. So, God's basically saying, "Nah, I'm blessing you. This is an inappropriate way to take my blessing, and now you want to disengage and set aside and essentially destroy some of your property. So, what I'm saying is that instead, again, we assume it's an interesting analysis that you might think that when a person is machrim, this is what he means. He just means to give it to the Kohanim. I want it set aside for God. But the Sefer Chinuch says, no, that's not what it means. It means that Be'etzim, you want to curse and destroy it. And God's saying, nope, you're not allowed. If you curse and destroy it and set it aside, I am decreeing that this property now belongs to my servants, the Kohanim. Lefi shekol asher li Yisrael shem chelek Hashem lohu. It really belongs to God. Uma shekona eved kona rabba. We have this halachic concept. that when a slave acquires property, it really goes straight to the domain of the master. Well, the same thing too, that our property is not really ours, that in a certain level it belongs to God. So if we want to destroy it, so God says, hey, I also have some stake rights over this property, a stake in this, so I'm giving it to my Kohanim. Aval mikol makom achar sheyodanu be'emes ki kavanas hamachir motzo sudovim reshuso roi lahashlim chepso v'yoshu b'reshus adonav v'yiyah kodesh. So it's not like God says, you know, you tried to put it in cherem, so I'm going to declare that ineffective and, you know, it remains yours. So no, rather, some of what you have enough control over the property that it is removed from your personal ownership, and it goes into God's ownership, so to speak, and is given to the Kohanim. V'zeh she'amar kasu b'samuch, kol cherem asher yachara min ha'adam lo yipode mos yuma. So what's it talking about in the few psukim later where it says that anything that's put into cherem shall be killed? So not talking about this type of cherem. She'inyanu al derech ha'pshat she'amachrim min ha'adam she'eino shelo. This is not talking about when you're machrim your own property. When you're machrim your own property, it goes to the Kohanim, like we said. It's not destroyed or killed, if it's alive. So that's what Klal Yisrael says to promises God when they go to war. So then if I win, so I'm going to put all the property in cherem. She'amusu means that the people are going to die. Ki shara umos einam besoch mayin habrachos kemo shemayinu. The other nations are not part of the wellspring of blessing. Uloshon cherem nispas leim upoal b'hem. So you don't have this restriction that you can't totally be machrim Jewish property because it goes against the divine blessing, but you can be machrim property that doesn't belong to you that you will capture in war, and it will be, the idea is that it will be completely destroyed. V'chein perish ha-kosuv ha-zeh ha-Ramban. If you look in the Ramban's commentary on that verse, Zichron HaVracha, Al-Tzad HaPshat, V'afal b'sheish bo ba-kosuv midroshos rabim, Shivim panim l'tor v'chol ha-nechochim la-mevim. So he says that the Ramban brings a couple of the midrashic explanations of that pasuk, one of which is that it's another indication that if somebody is sentenced to death, so you're not allowed to redeem that person for money. You might think that if the person offers enough bail, so to speak, so they'll be spared the death penalty, so that's not allowed. That's one of the midrashim. But the simple understanding of the pasuk is the way that the Sefer Chinuch presented it in the name of the Ramban, which is that the lashon, when you say that you're going to be machrim non-Jewish property that's captured in war, that then the full extent of what a cherem really is, which is total destruction, can rest on that property, whereas on Jewish property, which is directly the beneficiary of divine blessing, so it cannot be, the full cherem is not done to its full extent. Again, not necessarily it's recommended to do cherem to other properties, but if one does it, so then it would be it would have the full effect. So this is why the Kohanim and the Levim cannot be machrim their property, because their property is even more closely tied to God. Even if he says, I want my field to become cherim, it's as if he said nothing. That he's a complete beneficiary of God's blessing and beneficence. Is that a word? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So the that he's totally not applicable to the idea of a cherem. So chabracha in mokom lecherem chavila. That it's impossible to apply the concept of cherem at all, even in its limited form, to Kohanic or Levi property. Midinei mitzvah. What are the laws of the mitzvah? Ma she'amru zichron lebracha. Ma bein chermei kohanim lechermei shamayim. What's the difference between the charamim, which are given to the kohanim, and charamim, which are given to the Beis Hamikdash? Shechermei shamayim hekdesh v'nivdoyim b'shaviyahan. So if you say, this is going to be cherem, and instead of the kohanim, I want it to go to God, so it's going to be sanctified, but it could be redeemed just like any other sanctified property. You can redeem it with money and instead give the money to the Beis HaMikdash and keep the thing. And as soon as you redeem it with money, so the money is given to the Beis HaMikdash and the property is restored to its non-consecrated status. So if you specify that it's for a kohen, or according to the way we paskin, if you just without modification declare a property to be cherem, so ein lem pidyon leolam. Once you say this, it is non-redeemable, no returns, no refunds accepted. Ela nitanim la kohanim kitruma. It must be given to the kohanim. There's no other recourse. Should not be sold and not be redeemed. It should not be sold to anyone else. And it may not be redeemed by the owner. The owner says, whoops, I changed my mind, don't really want to be macherim this property. He can't redeem it himself, and he cannot sell it to another person before he gives it to the kohen. Whether it's real estate or movable objects, nitanim lekohanim shebo'oso mishmar b'shar shemachrim. So who gets it? Which kohanim? A lot of kohanim. So it's subdivided and shared by all the kohanim who are on duty at the time that you create, that you made this cherem. V'cher mekohanim. They're on duty in the Beis HaMikdash, obviously. So it's an interesting process that it goes through. So if you make a cherem, so while at the time, say you're machrim your gold watch, so this gold watch, while it remains in your jewelry box, it is now sanctified property. Absolute sanctified property. It's a holy property of God. Now you take the watch and you hand it to the Kohen. That watch, once you hand it to the Kohen, immediately all holiness disappears. It now becomes the regular property of the Kohen. This is as opposed to something like Truma. That the Truma, which is the percentage of the produce which is supposed to be given to the Kohanim, so you give it, it's holy. As soon as you separate it from the other produce, the truma is holy. You give it to the Kohen, it remains holy. Only Kohanim are allowed to eat it. Or their wives or slaves, etc. But, let's say, it's more... But here it's different. It's more like the Miser. The Miser, which is the... object, which is the tenth, the tithe of the produce that is given to a Levi, not to the Kohen. So that is separated out, and you give it to a Levi, but there's no holiness intrinsic to the Levi. If you give your miser to your friend, the next door neighbor who's a Levi, and the Levi invites you over for dinner that night and prepares a salad from the miser, so you're allowed to eat it. That's completely fine as long as it's given to the Levi. So here it's somewhere in between. That the cherem, before you give it to the Kohen, it has holiness. And once you give it to the Kohen, it no longer has holiness. So if you you give your gold watch to the Kohen, and the Kohen says, oh, here's my beautiful watch, and now he has a friend who's a Yisrael, and the Yisrael says, oh, you know, I have a really important business meeting next week, can I borrow your gold watch? It's completely fine for the non-Kohen to wear the watch because it has no holiness.
But that is akin to the maser for the Levi, which he then offers as part of the meal, because...
Well, once you give it to the Kohen, yes, but I'm saying...
Not before.
I'm saying, no, but what I mean is a maser, the difference is that with maser, the Yisrael separates it out from his produce, and now he munches on it. So that's not permissible because he's required to give it to the Levi. So it's just a monetary issue now. It's not a ritual.
Right.
So in other words, the Miser never had
after
intrinsic holiness.
After he gives it to the Levi,
no, but here it has intrinsic
property of the Levi, and the Levi can share it with whoever it is that he wants.
The difference, right. But the difference that I meant, why it's not exactly like the Miser, is because the object before it's given to the Kohen does have absolute holiness. Mm-hmm. So if you used it, it would now be a ritual infraction and not just a monetary infraction. That's what I meant. It's sort of like Truma before you give it to Cohen, and then like Meiser after you give it to Cohen. That's the point I was trying to bring out. Shenemar kolcherem b'Yisrael l'fayyeh. Okay. Uzdei chermo shel kohen eina chozeres labailim arishonim la'olam. And if you sanctify your field and you give it to the and you, I mean, not to sanctify, but you if you make your field a cherem and now the kohen takes possession of it, so what happens at the yovel? Does not go back. When the cherem, which is given to the kohen, is removed from the ancestral property of this person. It does not return to the owner at the yovel, but it now becomes the property of the kohen completely. Right. So now, if the kohen sold this field to someone else, even if he sold it back to the original owner, whose ancestral land it was at the yovel, it would go back to the kohen. Not to the original, not the original owner. It's permissible, yes. The Kohen is allowed to sell it back to the original owner after he receives it. Yes. V'yaser protea b'perek shmini me'erchin v'rishon nidarim. This is found in the eighth perek of Maseches Erchin and the first perek of Nidarim. B'noeges b'zman avayis b'nizchar menukevos al b'zman azek v'aramarnu b'mitzvah rishonah shebeseder zeh she'ein machrim. And in theory, it could happen nowadays, but you shouldn't do it. If you did it nowadays, so what should you do if you declare your property cherem, which you're not supposed to do? You should give it to the kohanim who are in your town, because there's no mishmar. No mishmar anymore, so there's nothing to be done about that.
The example that you gave about the gold watch that was given to a kohen, and since that gold watch is not just now the property of that one kohen, but the ones who are on duty,
right? They would have to share it. They would have to share it, right?
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but let's say they came. All right, you're right. It was just an example.
Yeah, I could lend it to his buddy.
I mean, so right, the gold watch would become the property of all the kohanim on duty, and then if all but one say, I have no interest in a gold watch, and you know, I'd rather have some cash, and one person says, oh, I love gold watches, so then they would pay, you know, he would have to pay the other kohanim for their portion in it, and then he would have the entire thing, yeah. Okay. Yep. Another problem, by the way, this is raised by the Minchas Chinuch over here, which is why nobody mentions that it's a problem in terms of making someone something a cherem nowadays, that you're putting yourself into a situation where you have to relate to an absolute kohen. What do I mean? That the kohanim nowadays are not kohanim miyuchasim. Kohanim nowadays are not of certain lineage, meaning that we assume they're kohanim, but if the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt tomorrow, it's a shaila exactly what would have to be done. That's why one of the things maybe Eliyahu HaNavi is going to do before Mashiach comes is he's going to point out which kohanim are real kohanim and which are not. So,
oh my God, I could have married that woman.
No, we haven't. You have. This is only lechumra. You have to be treated as a kohen. But here, this would be a problem if you were machrim something and you gave it to a kohen who's not really a kohen. So the Minchas Chinuch points out, you know, for Pidyon HaBen, you have no choice. So Pidyon HaBen, you know, you have a baby, and okay, I have no choice. Now I have to do the best I can, and you know, come up with a kohen and give him five shloim.
But by the way, it's interesting. Israeli medical geneticists have made a study about kohanim, and they've come to evidence that there is a certain type of genetic marker which is passed through the mitochondria.
You mean the Y chromosome?
No.
Mitochondria is go down by the female line.
Only through the female line that it's passed through.
No, that's a different thing. I think you're talking about who's Jewish and who's not Jewish. But in terms of who's a Kohen and who's not a Kohen, so there is a marker that they found on the Y chromosome of a very high percentage of
Kohanim.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
And what was fascinating is that in Africa there is some sort of a little tribe in South Africa which claims that they are part of the original lost tribes, and they've been following certain of the principles which were set out for Kohanim. So the Israeli geneticists went and studied them, and they found, yes, there are certain genetic indicators which would give some possible validity to their claim.
That's fine, but that doesn't mean that they're halakhically even Jewish.
Not,
you know?
No, of course not. I'm just saying that it's fascinating. It's
if a Kohen, unfortunately, has a child with a non-Jewish woman, so the child is going to be a goy with the...
Of course.
The child is going to be a goy with a Cohen gene, so that we that doesn't the genetics per se. You know, it's very interesting. It's nice to know that you know high percentage of Kohanim do have a you know a male line genetic marker, but we have in halacha we have to go mostly based on a chazaka as opposed to yeah. So for Pidyon HaBen, yeah, so you have no choice. You have a baby, and you have to find someone who's a Cohen to the best of your knowledge. But to put yourself into a situation by machrim your property. That you need to find a real Kohen in order to fulfill a halacha, to put yourself into that situation, how could you do that nowadays? Because you don't know that Kohanim are really Kohanim 100% for sure. So that's...
And the consequences are much more severe than, say, having, you know, the opinion of Ben with somebody who maybe wasn't a real Kohen.
Right. Yeah, so an unredeemed Bechor is neglected to fulfill a positive commandment. That's right.
We can always catch up on that.
Right, that's why the Vilna Gaon famously used to, he was a Bechor, so he used to, every time he found a new Kohen that he never met before, he used to redeem himself. He used to pull out 5 slime from his pocket and give it to the Kohen because just in case the previous Kohanim, the one that his father used when he was first born and the one that, the ones he'd used before, just in case they weren't really Kohanim. Yeah. So he used to try to do a. He used to be poda himself from any coin he found, just on the off chance that he would on among all of these there be one who was a real 100% sure coin. So they said one time he found one who was miyuchas, who had like documents for his lineage. He's like, and he after that he stopped being poda from every coin. He says, if I didn't get it by now with this guy, so you know I'm not going to do it. But it's hard to imagine that. You know, that's what God really wants, you know? Probably just, you have to do the best you can, find the best coin you can, and make Pidyon HaBen. Okay. Shehem. Fine. V'shem nitan l'ganem l'nitzoyim b'osem mokom sh'akarka sh'b'chutz l'aretz dino k'metalta l'inyan zeh. V'alim hechrim karka b'eretz Yisrael ein acherim. But if you have real estate in Eretz Yisrael, so that as if you cannot have a cherem nowadays. A cherem for fields in Eretz Yisrael only is applicable in the times of the Yovel. The over azel v'hecher min achos avelo nesanim lakoin ola bedek habayis bozan stodim sheperashim shalom talam bedek habayis bitol aseza. So not only did you if you were machrim something and you didn't treat it properly, then not only did you neglect to fulfill this positive commandment, but you have a very severe punishment because you treated sanctified objects improperly. Because again, it doesn't become desanctified until it's given properly to a kohen.